Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is August 26th, 2002. Today's session is Does Violence Save Us? Presented by Mary Strewfoot. The session number is STM2002-01. Let's listen in.
My name is Mary Strewfoot. I'm doing a series this week, beginning today and ending on Saturday, on different aspects of Christology. And today, the session is, Does Violence Save Us? And what I want to do is look at the violence that is at the center of the atonement, the work of Jesus to redeem us to God, and do some of our own work about that, as well as look at what some different scholars, both feminist and biblical scholars, think and say about it in relation to what Lutheran theologians are saying about it. The first thing that I wanted to get us to think about Christology, or Christ, who is Jesus, is to reflect on this summer's theme. And all summer there have been celebrations for the 40th anniversary of Holden. And the verses for that are from Deuteronomy 8, verses 7 through 9, and I'll read them. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land flowing with streams, with springs and underground waters welling up in valleys and hills. A land where you may eat bread without scarcity, where you will lack nothing. A land whose stones are iron, and from whose hills you may mine copper. One of the things that struck me from those verses is it seems to me an invitation to trust God, an invitation to be in a relationship with God. And earlier this summer, I spent 2 weeks here during a work camp time when everyone who was here was working to repair and to get things done around here. And Pastor Dan Erlander, a long-time Holden figure, was here doing our Bible study, and he reflected for the 2 weeks on the role of the wilderness as the wilderness school, a place where God took the Israelites to learn about being in relationship to God, to learn how to be faithful to God. And as I thought about, well, who is Jesus? Who is the Christ? I thought about the relationship between the Israelites' wilderness, a place where the Israelites were taken to learn about trust and relationship with God, then Holden as a place that seekers seek, as a place set apart to be pushed into closer relationship with God. And then I also think about the Christ as a place, not a place, a relationship in which we learn to trust God more fully. As an example of how does the wilderness press us into learning more about God and a more intimate relationship with God, I was on long-term staff 11 years ago, and my now husband and I met here, and early on in our relationship we went on a somewhat late fall hike out to Heart Lake. Just past Heart Lake, there is a camp called Rebel Camp. And we were just getting to know each other, and we had borrowed a very small backpacking tent. And the night that we spent there, we woke up with the tent roof close to our nose in the morning because it had snowed, very heavy snow, had snowed into our boots, which we had mistakenly left outside of the tent. And the food, which we had carefully strung up in the trees to keep away from bears, had been invaded by ground squirrels, and all of our breakfast had been eaten. So in this microcosm of a wilderness experience, we became more acquainted with each other. And those having no food and having snow forced us to rely a little bit more on each other. As we hiked into the village, there were bear tracks going our direction in the snow, which terrified me quite a bit, having not experienced an encounter with a bear before. And this furthered my intimacy with this young man who became my husband, because I found out that he could be very cheerful and positive indeed in the face of trial, even though I couldn't. So just a micro example of how do we come into an intimate relationship through wilderness experience. What I'd like to do is then move right into talking about practical examples of how some scholars see that the violence of the atonement, the crucifixion of Jesus, when it's translated in practical terms into real lives, is devastating. And I'm relying for my examples from two particular books. The first one was ordered for the bookstore but did not come in. If you are interested in purchasing a copy of it, the manager said she can take your name and address and your money and send it to you. The publisher did not have any. It's by two authors, Rita Nakashima Brock and Rebecca Ann Parker, called Proverbs of Ashes. And the whole book is reflections on their own experiences from their own lives and people they have counseled, as a pastor, that bring to the surface what does this violence at the center of atonement mean for us. The other is also happens to be in the bookstore, and it's by Dolores Williams. She is an African-American theologian who teaches at Union Theological Seminary, called Sisters in the Wilderness. The first examples I'll take are from Rebecca Parker. She has served many years as a Methodist minister in Seattle. And two of the examples that she gives in the book are from her pastoral experiences. One is there was a woman named Enola Reed who was being abused by her husband physically. And they had together four small children, one of them a baby. And she got counseling and had a restraining order on the husband, and he was finally then put in jail for a while. When it was time for him to get out of jail, she had to make the decision, do I keep him away from here, or do I let him come back? And she decided that it was okay to suffer like Jesus did in order to keep the family together, in order for the children to have a father at home. She thought that her suffering was like Jesus's, and therefore it was okay. So she let him come back home, and eventually the husband murdered Enola Reed in front of two or three of the children. Another example from her pastoral experiences, she was working in her office, and someone knocked on the door, and a woman who regularly passed by the church to go to the bus stop to her work stopped by, and a Catholic woman from a Latina background said, you know, I needed to talk to you. I noticed on the sign outside that you were a woman priest, and I thought maybe you could answer my question. And she divulged that her husband had both verbally and physically abused her for a number of years, and that she didn't know what to do because it was either 10 or 20 years previous. She had gone to her priest and said, this is happening, what should I do? And the priest's response was, well, you can suffer like Jesus did, It is fine to suffer because that is our model. And the woman continued to struggle with that and felt like it was not what she was supposed to do. And when she asked Rebecca Parker this, Parker felt unable to answer it first, because she had just preached the Sunday before a sermon on sacrificial love, and that love knows no bounds and will sacrifice to any limit. But she knew, of course, that the answer had to be, well, of course, Jesus doesn't want you to be abused by your husband and to suffer like this. The third example comes from her own life, and this one seems to have most particularly caused Parker to struggle with, what am I doing as a Christian minister, and what are we doing as Christians and lay people and theologians about this? She was a young pastor, somewhat newly married, and her husband had wanted to start a family, and so they decided to try to have a family. Some months later, Parker was pregnant, and in her joy with this news, they went to a restaurant, their favorite restaurant, and she was holding his hands across the table and telling him the good news that she's pregnant now. And immediately he recoiled and his face fell, and he said, I'm not ready for this. I can't do this. This is not what I'm about. And withdrew from her. And in subsequent days, she felt compelled to have an abortion in order to save him from what he feared and her marriage, feeling as if she had the child, he would abandon her, and she did not want to lose the marriage. And after she had the abortion, she realized, what sacrifice have I made at what cost? Why was this decision so easy, to make a sacrifice to save someone else? So, as I said, this book is full of questions. We'll try to get to some answers together. The other examples are more, they are personal, but they're more sociological. Dolores Williams looks at the social role of surrogacy in African-American women's lives. And she has divided this into two to say that during slavery, African-American women experienced coerced surrogacy, in that they were coerced by violence, basically, to be mammies, to put their own energy in the place of male energy in the fields, to work just as hard as the men, and also to be the sexual partners of slave masters and to bear their children. Then she also looks at what kind of surrogacy was prominent after the war, after Civil War. Yes?
By surrogacy, do you mean just for having to perform roles that other than they would normally perform, or what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I'm sorry, yeah, a replacement. To be a replacement, like in mammies, to be a replacement for the white women being the mother, or the white women running the household, and that the mammies were given basically incredible authority within a plantation owner's household. And so they were performing roles that they were being forced into.
What roles would they perform ordinarily?
Had they been free, or had they...
Yeah.
Well, they would have been in Africa still then.
Okay, I was just curious what the term...
Surrogacy? Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't make that clear. It's as a replacement, as a forced someone to play the role for someone else.
Okay.
That you're not choosing for yourself. So that's why she divides it into coerced, meaning under slavery there were no options other than being whipped or trying to run away. And then in the antebellum period after the war, she talks about voluntary surrogacy. And what the picture she paints in that is also kind of a mammy role, in that given the poverty and the racism that ensued the war, that black women were still forced to play the role of being in charge of the children or the household for white families. So that they continue to have to kind of sacrifice their own time with their own families, love for their own families, to, under slavery, bear the children for the masters, or to be the head of their household goings on, the business part of it. And Williams thinks that these kinds of roles are supported by the fact that at the center of Christianity is this idea that there's a sacred surrogate. Surrogate meaning someone taking the place of someone else, that there is a sacred person who has taken on violence for everyone else. And that because this is the center of belief, then that legitimates having this translated into human lives. What Williams wants to do is find a theory of, well, what does Jesus do for us that is not violent? And compared to Brock and Parker, Williams gives a solution and says, what the work that Jesus did do for us was his vision of ministry, the way that he lived his ministry, and his vision for people with each other in their lives together, helping each other. Are there any questions so far on what I've covered as far as what other people have said?
Lots of questions, but I'm not sure which one to ask.
Yeah. Okay, because we'll get to some practical things that we'll do that might help us move on to sorting out some of the myriad ones you have. Okay. So just to repeat, atonement is to atone. The verb itself means just simply to make amends. And in Christianity, the atonement has come to mean the work of Jesus to die to bring us back to God. So atone, to make amends, but in Christianity, the atonement is assigned to the work of Jesus dying to take us, to bring us to God. So let's do some practical things. Maybe I should have explained a little bit about myself. I'm a lifelong Lutheran, and the questions that I'm asking are all questions that are in a doctoral dissertation that I'm in the midst of writing. And I would have to confess that these are also purely personal questions. I need to know what these are. And I happen to be doing it in an academic format because hopefully it will land me a job someday. So I'm very interested in not only what do academics say, but what do we as Lutherans say? How does what non-Lutheran theologians saying, and what Lutheran theologians are saying, and what we as thinking, believing, caring human beings, how does this all interact? So a few more people came than there had been hymnals for, but what I'd like us to do, you may have to double up on Psalms 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 11. Oh, we do have enough. So if everybody could take a hymnal. Mm-hmm. Someone need one more?
Oh, over here.
Do you have one?
Well, we have one.
Yeah, and there's even one more extra. Okay. Let me think how many I have here. So if you could, let's see. Every 2 to 3 people will kind of divide up, and you don't have to sit in a small group, but you're welcome to. But as a group, I'll have you looking at certain things. And what I'd like you to be doing is looking at images of the atonement in these different sections. So one of the three of you, you two guys and the woman in blue here, you could look at the Holy Communion liturgy at setting 2, including the order of confession. So those are pages 77 to 83. And then the woman with the denim shirt and the guy with the suspenders, the second half of the same liturgy, so pages 84 to 95. Let's see. Then, and I forgot your name, I met you the other night.
Inga?
Inga. Okay, and Franz. Hymns 202 and 204. And then a couple in front here. Hymns 293 and 296. And then last two women, hymn 94. And you can also look at 148. So we'll take about 5 minutes, or might not take that long.
2 or 3.
And look at what images of atonement are there. What is the work that Jesus is doing to save us? So what work is Jesus doing in these things to save us? So why don't we look at the first half of the liturgy, what kinds of images, I mean, and you don't have to make sure you call everyone, if that's not possible, mm-hmm. But what kinds of images do you see in the first half of the communion setting?
There's the statements of absolution, the conclusion of the brief order for confession and forgiveness, whereby the presiding minister, recalls that God gave his son to die.
Okay.
For us.
Okay, so.
And in both of, there's two different kinds of absolutions, but in each of them, the declaration that the son was sent to die.
Okay. God gives or sends?
As a response to human sinfulness.
Or sins. Okay. Are there other images in the first half?
Both of the hymns of praise talk about the Lamb taking away the sin of the world in the first hymn of praise, and the Lamb being slain, and the Lamb's blood setting us free.
Okay. What about the second half of the liturgy? What kinds of images are there?
Well, in both the Nicene and the Apostles' Creed, talks about that Jesus comes down from heaven, by the power of the Holy Spirit, was made man, crucified, suffered, death, was buried, rose again in accordance to the Scripture. So
what part? How would you interpret that as what Jesus' work is for us?
To die for us.
Okay. So, well, but to die again. Okay. Were there other images from the second half? But what does Jesus do?
I don't know what this part of it is, but says, in mercy for our fallen world, you gave your only son, that all who believe in him should not perish, but have eternal life.
Okay, so God gives or sends sons, so I'll start to do hash marks for our repeated ones. What about the next, first two hymns? What kinds of images were there?
Are we looking for anything that Jesus did for us, or specifically related to his crucifixion?
No, whatever images there are, what to redeem us, to bring us to God. Okay. Images of what?
There's a lot of stuff about giving us the sacrament of the communion.
Okay.
To bring us.
Okay, so.
Which is a gift of life, it says.
Okay, what about the hymns 202 and 204? And I tried to pick some that are kind of, hymns that I love to sing, that, they resound from childhood, at least for me. What kinds of images are there?
There's the victim divine.
Okay.
The precious dead. Spotless lamb.
Precious death. Oops. Victim divine.
Spotless lamb.
Okay. Any others that?
Jesus' blood being sort of a payment to God, a ransom payment.
Blood, a ransom. Okay. What about the next group of people? Your hymns.
Mine is Just As I Am with that one, please. So it's basically the sacrificial lamb of God.
The sacrifice?
For me. Shed his blood for me.
So,
the second one there, lamb slain, blood.
Okay, and it's personal this time.
Yes, very personal.
Okay.
Me.
So we'll add that as.
It must be the choir practice.
Yeah. Yesterday I did the same thing. Why is the bell ringing at 5:30? Okay. Were there other pertinent images in?
This one is. That we're saved, we're not by our own merits, but by Jesus' blood and his righteousness.
Okay.
Our word.
So blood, right. But also righteousness.
Righteousness, yeah.
Okay, and then the last two hymns.
My Lord should take frail flesh and die for me, See, who am I that for my sake he could take his life?
Okay. Are there other ones from those?
The other one is, now the green blade rises. Christ died, he laid in the grave 3 days, and he rises again. Love has come again like rising green. Like wheat, a rising grain.
And how would you interpret that?
He died and he laid in the grave for 3 days.
Okay, so there is the death given to die for us.
Yeah. And the resurrection.
Right. What?
There's a lot of that in the second half of the communion thing too.
Okay, so there is some. We'll have somewhat separated. So resurrection and in the now the green blade rises, I interpreted that as new life.
Right.
Yeah. As a result of death, like you pointed out.
There's one more thing. And this is my hope is built on that thing less. And there's, it's it's more than just Jesus doing something out there. It's that we have to be found in him or clothed in him or something. We have to take part in something. We have to be in him, found in him, and become like him or whatever.
Okay. So maybe to be clothed in?
Clothed is the word he says.
Oh, is that?
That may I then be found, may in him be found clothed in his righteousness alone. So it's clothed in him.
Okay.
Something.
Or to put on.
Some kind of participation of us in this.
Okay. Okay, so that is almost, I'd almost put that on this side. Doesn't seem, participation doesn't seem to be quite as violent as these images. Would you agree or disagree?
That's fine. It's about, it would be about the new life that we are emulating of his or whatever.
Okay.
That we partake of the new life that he's given.
So our participation. Okay. In addition to the now, the green blade rises, I wanted to point out, especially having grown up using the old red hymnal where this was sung every Sunday. In the liturgy on page 93, the Nunc Dimittis, it was the Latin for now let us depart, Lord, now let your servant go in peace. Your word has been fulfilled. My own eyes have seen the salvation which you have prepared in the sight of every people. : a light to reveal you to the nations. And this setting is a setting that I sing nearly every Sunday in my church. And I, reading through it, it's not a section that my church sings very often, and I was thrilled to be reminded of the childhood image, something that is saying the salvation is not the blood given. The salvation is Jesus himself as the light to show God. So I just want to hold up this one contrasting image that doesn't have to do with blood, that's saying this salvation is the light which Jesus is. So what, now comes the sticky part, and want to acknowledge that, having said I'm a lifelong Lutheran, I'm not, my intention in having us look at liturgy and hymns is not to do away with it, to cut it out, or to ignore it, but to continue to wrestle with it and find out what does this mean for us as we continue to sing these images and to pray these images. And so what I'd like to do now is ask you some questions of how does this make you feel? I've had casual conversations with a number of Lutherans since I started writing my dissertation, and some people say, yeah, this gets me really angry. I don't know what to do with this. And other people that I love dearly don't want to hear any of these questions and think, don't take this away from me. This is central to what I think and who I am in God. And I'm curious, if you've thought about this before, in what ways has it troubled you, or what conclusions have you come to in being at peace with the kinds of liturgies and hymns that we have in our Lutheran tradition? And I think there's another. Yeah. So maybe the best question to start with, do these images fit your own understanding of what Jesus does for us? And if they don't, what do you do as a faithful person with the fact that this is what we have in our tradition?
I would say I'm very comfortable with atonement images for Jesus. Mm-hmm. I think sacrifice chosen is a beautiful thing. I think sacrifice imposed, like the stories that you portrayed at the beginning of the woman's book. I don't recall the name of the book, but the name of the woman, but that's very different. So that when someone says, you know, something like they feel like they need to stay in an abusive relationship because that's what Jesus would have them do, that to me is sacrifice imposed rather than sacrifice chosen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, a really critical distinction. I mean, I'm a lifelong Lutheran too, and I'm a pacifist, but I'm not troubled by God's choosing to sacrifice on behalf of others. I'm troubled, though, by somebody assuming that because they've been, you know, they're a Christian and they're being abused, that that's somehow the quote-unquote the cross they have to bear. That's a bunch of bull, I think.
Right.
You know, but I think good theology can correct that. good atonement theology can correct that.
Okay. I
have actually never been able to understand that. I'm a Lutheran too, though from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I was theologically trained, and it's taken me a long time to even understand that concept. So I have a hard time with it. And I have a hard time with it also because what kind of image of God does that create? God the Father, who obviously needs that blood of his own son to be able to accept us again. I just don't understand. I mean, that kind of a brutal Father God is not mine.
Mm-hmm. And is the liturgy that we looked at here in any way similar to the liturgy that you use at home?
Well, yeah, it is. And I find it easier to sing along here because I just shut out the words. I treat it as if it was Latin.
Right, which is easier to do.
And the melodies are beautiful, but if I really listened to the words, I couldn't sing them, to be honest.
Okay.
I think there's a difference between, say, the hymn of Victim Divine and then the communion, like the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed or whatever.
The Nicene Creed, right, is more direct in its sacrifice. Mm-hmm.
I think you could understand Jesus as a sacrifice of some kind, even a sacrifice of atonement, without the atonement being required by God for us, or maybe not atonement, I don't know, but I think you can understand Jesus's, you know, work as a sacrifice without, I guess I have a little trouble understanding the God requiring blood for our sins, so Jesus paid it for us.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it makes some sense, but I think you can understand the crucifixion in other ways too, like this, that it's a sacrifice and it accomplishes something, but maybe something a little different than that.
Mm-hmm. So a different interpretation of the crucifixion might relieve some of the pressure? Is that on
yeah, just that somebody needed blood, but it wasn't necessarily God. You know, I mean, it was people.
That's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah.
I like that. Can I quote you? I'll get your name later.
Okay, if I'm directing it too far away, it's okay to bring me back to center again. I guess I have so much trouble with
the whole image of God being male, because I see that as the first part of the abuse that begins to take place in society, is a whole language thing that kind of gives permission for this kind of thing to happen in the first place. I think our language does make a difference, and I think as a church we're so far behind in recognizing what that does to all of society, to say that it is okay to only see God in a male image. But again, I mean, I think that's kind of the first abuse that takes place.
Okay, right. So you're pointing to something a few steps back.
Right,
that exactly. Feeds into an image of power that right. is not always appropriate for what we would hope the religious life would be.
Right.
Okay.
A few years ago, there was a guy named Michael Shepherd. He was a gay man who was tied to a fence
oh, right.
and beaten to death in Colorado.
In Wyoming.
Pardon?
In Wyoming.
In Wyoming. Mm-hmm. And thinking about the effect of that news on some of the people in my congregation. I mean, there's always been a lot of gay bashing, bashing of various kinds of college people.
Mm-hmm.
But the particular brutality of that I think had a kind of a saving value in that the horror of the horror of the consequence of one might hold a thought, you know, gay people are somehow inferior. And then you take the logic of that to its end, you end up with Michael Shepherd on a fence.
Okay.
So as terrible as that was, it had a sort of a demonstrative power, you know, about what does it mean to hold prejudice in your soul? If you the consequence of that, of even the beginnings of it in yourself. And I wondered then, is he a type of Christ when we think of Christ on the cross? Of that violence, of the, you know, the theme of here's one who comes living justice and living innocence and living welcome.
Mm-hmm.
And the powers that be are alarmed in such a way that the attractiveness and beauty of that that they have to destroy it. And that becomes then a type for the way that happens to you, you know. And I don't have perfect language for this, but mm-hmm. what I'm trying to say, there's a redemptive value in that, terrible as it is, for those who are horrified by the sight of it. And I think perhaps we have lost, in the way we've talked about it, we've lost some of the horror of the cross, because I think it ought to horrify us,
mm-hmm.
horrify us in a way that saves us, in a way that changes our minds.
Do you mean in a way, almost as a mirror to ourselves?
As a mirror to ourselves.
Okay.
Well, Martin Luther King said the same way, you know, what we are is a mirror. You know, when they come at us with dogs or water hose or whatever, we do not respond with violence because we want our suffering to be a mirror to these people of what their own hatred is.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I'm thinking in along those lines. As a, so when I think of, you know, is there value in the suffering? You know, it's a value you wouldn't want to. You wouldn't want to have the suffering, and you wouldn't want the value to be there, but since it is there, I want to say, is there something there? If there's a way out of it, or where it could be valuable,
mm-hmm.
it shines some light on the souls of those of us who, by intention or inaction,
mm-hmm.
or by allowing some kind of stuff be in ourselves, that light that shines back to us from it can be, maybe I'm psychologizing here some, but it can be saving for us to see what is the end of it, mm-hmm. you know, when we allow our own hatreds to just be.
Mm-hmm. But then I think you end up, I mean, the argument in which, you know, nonviolent non-participation and taking on that role of victim as a way of turning people's minds around, because if you take the violence that they are doing to someone to an extreme, they will eventually see how awful it is, recognize the common humanity, and stop.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure whether I really think this, but I kind of do. It's an argument that works in a political realm and in a as a solution for social evils, but does it work as a theological solution? I mean, does it, if you take it out of, you know, turning, if you take it out of the realm of allowing people who are in a position of power to recognize the evil that they're doing to people who are not in a position of power, and really, I think in the cases where nonviolent non-cooperation works, who are in a position of being less than people. I mean, I think it kind of depends on that, because that's what forces you to recognize them as people. But I'm not sure whether that works as a theological explanation. I mean, is that a separate, you know, are those worlds mm-hmm. that separate?
That's a good question.
Right, or can we ultimately separate them? Is it possible to separate them, or are they so tightly interwoven that we end up with really messy areas of them? Just a question to add to your question. I'm going to jump ahead in my carefully planned outline here. And one of the things I wanted to do, I really appreciate getting me to think in a on the lines of something I was heading towards but not grasping at all, was a question, or something I wanted to point out was, well, but isn't this crucifixion at the center of both our symbols in the Christian faith and in our thinking? You know, that we wear crosses around our necks. We don't wear tombstones, which would symbolize the new life. We don't wear new blades of grass. We wear crosses. And one of the things that one of the historical scholars that I have studied and whose work in part I find very helpful is John Dominic Crossan. And some of you probably have read some of him. He's also a figure whose name can have very good responses and very poor responses because of things that he said. But one of the things that I appreciate is his insistence on remembering the brutality of crucifixion. And I wanted to share a little bit of what he says. He talks about the fact that thousands and thousands of people were crucified and during the time of Roman occupation of Palestine in the ancient world. And despite the fact that there were thousands and thousands of people, that fact having been recorded by various historical writers of the time who were eyewitnesses to the multiple crucifixions, that only one crucified skeleton has been recovered through archaeological digs, and that was in 1968. Now, this book was published in 94. I don't know what's happened in the 8 years hence, but my guess is not a great many more have been found. Let's see. I wanted to read the description of this skeleton. After appraisal and reappraisal by scholars from Israel's Department of Antiquities,
and Jerusalem's Hebrew University Medical School, the manner of crucifixion became clear. His arms had not been nailed, but tied to the bar of the cross, probably with arms to elbows over and behind it. His legs had been placed on either side of the upright beam, with separate nails holding the heel bone to the wood on each side. A small olive wood plaque had been set between the nail's head and the heel bone, lest the condemned man manage to tear his foot free from the nail. But the nail in the right heel had struck a knot in the upright, and its point had become bent, so that when the man was taken down, the nail, olive wood, and heel bone all remained fixed together in burial and discovery. Finally, there was no evidence that the man's legs had been broken after crucifixion to speed his death by more instant asphyxiation. I'll also share one other passage. There was a man named Josephus who was a Jewish scholar. He was an historian, and he recorded much of what happened during Roman occupation of Palestine. And this is from early in the summer of 70 of the Common Era. Titus's army had completely encircled Jerusalem, and the siege was being pressed toward its awful consummation. And here's the quote from Josephus. "The majority of those who issued from the encircled city in search of food were citizens of the poorer class, who were deterred from deserting by fear for their families. When caught, they were scourged and subjected to torture of every description before being killed, and then crucified opposite the walls, that is, of the city, 500 or sometimes more being captured daily. The soldiers, out of rage and hatred, amused themselves by nailing their prisoners in different postures. And so great was their number that space could not be found for the crosses, nor crosses for the bodies." So one of the things I wanted to emphasize that Crossan has made me think about is the force with which crucifixion was used by the Roman governor or the Roman government as political terror. It was humiliating, to say the least, painful, to say the least, and used on largely those of the lower class, those who were political rebels, or somehow those who were a threat to Roman power. One of the things that was ultimately terrible about it was that because the ancients believed that burial was absolutely critical in honoring both the dead and God and themselves, that the threat of not being able to bury the person who had been crucified was an ultimate horror to those who lived in this land that was occupied, to the Jews themselves. So there were these multi-stranded threats and terror involved in crucifixion, not just the physical torment of the one person who was crucified. So I tie that in with what you were saying, and
I was just going to say, and something that does make me think about is that one of the ways in which it does, however, become in which, if at some point, kind of self-victimization, for lack of a better word, that's not quite the right word. If you take it out of the political realm, then the question, of course, is what does it come to mean for centuries of other Christians? And one of the things that was certainly true, and one of the only kind of ways in which I'm familiar with it is that particularly for medieval, and actually I would say particularly for medieval women, mystics and theologians, it became a very, very powerful image of the extent to which you could overcome travails of the body. And so even if this was, and I mean, you know, it's very hard as a modern day feminist in particular to read stories of Teresa of Avila and her in particular, probably more than almost any of the remaining, and who, I mean, literally, if you go through the page of her life, maybe every other page is, I hate my body, I hate myself, I hate this life I live, I hate this kind of unique individual being that's embodied in one spot. The ugliness she suffered smallpox, so in many ways she actually was like physically ugly, and then every other pages, and yet as low and as debased as I am, God loves me. And so it becomes in fact an image, and you know, mixed in with that of course is, you know, as terrible as Christ's suffering, as terrible as his own experiences with death, he was, you know, loved by God so much that he was restored. And so, and you know, and then, you know, this is living in the medieval time when billions and millions, well, not billions, but millions of people are dying from the plague, when the body is in fact really, really transitory and mm-hmm. really not a stable thing. You can't rely on your life being contained in that body for very long. So really don't, you know, so what that image may mean if you go back to its kind of unique and individual horror in that unique and individual historical setting versus what it comes to mean as, you know, now millions and millions of theologians have added on to it is very different. And I guess I would also argue that our own liturgy, I think, is quite obviously uncomfortable with the reality of it, and that's why you end up with, you know, that's why you end up singing, you know, the Lamb who was slain, as opposed to, you know, singing Christ who died a painful and horrible death on the cross, you know.
But the political political reality has become a theological image.
That's
the Jewish.
Oh, okay.
The Jewish.
That's biblical.
Sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
That's
okay.
Mm-hmm. But I think atonement. You can. I think you have to go back to the question of whether or not we have as part of our nature sinner, because I think atonement is response to that more than it is. This kind of God sending the son to die, kind of like Abraham raises his knife on Isaac. That kind of, I think atonement is more about God becoming flesh. You mentioned mm-hmm. that song, you know, the Simeon song, the you mm-hmm. know, the Nunc mm-hmm. Dimittis, that whole idea of you know, him pointing to Jesus is about Jesus being the divine. The divine is disclosed in Jesus. And yeah, he doesn't sing about the blood and the crust because Jesus is a baby. You know, I mean, that hasn't mm-hmm. happened yet. Mm-hmm. But he's gonna make, and my question is, could God becoming flesh have lived to a ripe old age? I don't think so in any age. I think we'd have killed him. And that atonement is about that, that God becomes so vulnerable as to die, and that. And for me, the cross is a nice image. I mean, I know it's gory and all that, but I mean, it's nice in the embrace that God makes of creation, in spite of the fact that creation doesn't love back.
And that's one of the things that one of the Lutheran systematic theologians that I'm studying has pointed out, that it's this crisis of God's way and the world's way, the old and the new, and you know, kind of your image of, but God in flesh could not have lived to a ripe old age, in any time. It's close to what you had just said, and I think that that's a really helpful thing to remember in thinking about the cross. If we think about Jesus as God, so here's God interacting with the world, and the world, what does the world want to do? either follow him or kill him. It's hot and cold. There aren't in-between responses.
You know there's no in-between. They just didn't write about the in-between responses. I'm sure there was millions of people out there that could have cared less.
Well, some of the historians of the time have kind of glancing blows that, you know, these are just crazy people. You know, all these peasants following this guy Christos. Don't know what their problem is, and the tradition keeps living on, and they keep multiplying. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you just said that there's the believers and the disbelievers, and in the middle there must have been a lot of other people. You know.
Yeah, but I wouldn't even divide it into believers and non-believers, but trying to hold on to the image of what is the response of the world when God is present. And then if you, this is starting to get into things for tomorrow, but I will forge ahead, that if you think about the presence of God in the world now, and we can, and as Christians we identify that presence as Jesus, as God with us, and that those with political power, those with the most to lose from this message of God are the ones who kill, and the ones with the least to lose are the ones who follow. And that's the dichotomy that I would set up more in this relationship that they're confronted with. The relationship that Jesus confronts them with to have with God terrifies those with power and embraces those without it in this particular setting in the ancient world.
I like what you just said, but kind of going back to what we were talking about. I think when I first became a Christian, I found out Jesus loved me and forgave me and forgave my sins and all that stuff. And so that image was really strong. But as I've done more ministry in the world, especially working with the poor, the image of Christ on the cross has been even more profound. But it's not so much that he's a sacrificial lamb, but he's more the God, like you've been talking about, that understands me, who has suffered and is with me in my suffering, mm-hmm. and the suffering of refugees and mm-hmm. in refugee camps. And so many people who died unjustly, and those people on the crosses, you know, it's more that God is with us. And during Good Friday, I had the opportunity to participate in an ecumenical Good Friday service in a Catholic church, and it was really refreshing for me to actually see Christ up there on the cross bleeding, you know, because mm-hmm. it was the real reality of seeing him suffering for with me, for my sins, whatever way you want to say it, suffering mm-hmm. with us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is one distinction, I think, even in the jewelry we wear. That Catholics tend to have more a body on the cross that's around their necks, and Protestants tend not to. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It seems so automatic. It's like if you jump off a high place, gravity's going to take you down, and you're going to hit the bottom and die. You know, it seems so automatic that if you stand up and tell people, the powerful people, that they should share what they have. And if you get a following, they're going to kill you. You know, and I wonder if it's not a reminder of that. I mean, it's just, I don't know, it just seems so automatic. I mean, there's almost no way you can get around it, you know, and so you walk around with this cross around your neck, and it's, you know, to me, that's one of the reminders of it. You know, it's kind of a scary proposition. It's no less than, you know, living in Roman times and looking out the walls of the city and seeing all those crosses mm-hmm. hanging up. It's if you take it to the limit, you know, in terms of other than just being a nice piece of jewelry mm-hmm. around right. your neck, you know, I don't know what that says about atonement, but to me, it just seems so automatic.
Okay, so it's like a reminder of the Jesus no-brainer. That it's a no-brainer that if you do this, you will die.
Yeah.
And, okay, right. And so that, and that connects to, we have to wrap up, so I will connect that to one other piece that I was going to share. And that is talking about a New Testament scholar who has training also in the classics, in Greek and Roman mythology, history, etc. His name is Gregory Riley, and this book is available in the bookstore, and it's called One Jesus, Many Christs. It's a fascinating read. There are no footnotes. And he talks about the interface of multiple ancient cultures and how both Persian ideas, because Persia conquered Babylon and then set the Israelites free to go home, and then also Alexander the Great, fourth century BCE, invading and bringing Greco-Roman ideals. And so he talks about Galilee being a crossroads of religious ideas. And from that, the heart of his thesis is that the way Jesus was talked about, because the Greco-Roman model of the hero was in everybody's head. It was how you told stories. And it was how you survived, because you needed to imitate a hero. He thinks that Jesus' story, whether or not Jesus is truly God, he thinks the story is told that Jesus is a hero, and here's how to follow him. Here's how to imitate him. Here is how to gain what he wants you to gain. And that, I think, is a reflection of what you were saying, Rilan, as this cross is a no-brainer. If you wear this, you're choosing to be a disciple, a student of this particular hero. So I'll end abruptly there so people can get to dinner. And you're welcome to come back tomorrow at 6:20, I guess it is, or you can also catch me around in the village.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks.